And we're rolling.
Tony. Antonio.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias, mi amor.
You should be on one of those like daytime soap operas. In Spanish.
Sí, mi amor. Okay. ¿Por qué no?
what would your character be? Like which archetype?
Antonio.
It'd be Antonio.
I'd be Antonio. I'd be a podcast producer and a DJ, and I'd be Antonio, and I would be, I would be you. That's who
you'd
I would
be. Me. Wow.
And I would have a luscious beard, just like you have, and a full head of beautiful, thick, black hair, and I would have the hearts of the nation.
Oh, wow. The nation.
The nation. Maybe even the world, depending on how much people enjoyed the show.
Man,
but I think they'd love it.
Should we pivot? Should we just make a soap opera?
I would need your help on that.
Forget this fitness thing. Like, forget podcasting.
I only know like 8 words in Spanish, so we have a lot of work to do. But actually, I don't know if I've told you the story. Mm-mm. If I can, like, if you just show me the words in Spanish, I can read it in a very good Spanish accent, even though I would know none of it. And it's actually crazy. So, like, I don't know why. I'm good with accents. I've always been good with accents. Did I tell you the story about the Vietnamese karaoke?
No.
Okay. So in college, there were a lot of Vietnamese people, the students that I like was friends with in college. And this is so funny. Especially in my first year, I like really hated school. I had just spent the year in Israel. Like, I didn't want to be hanging out with anybody, and I really didn't like school or the people there. And I just ended up befriending a number of my Vietnamese classmates. And like, they were like my like really good friends in my first year of college. And one day they invited me over to one of their houses for a dinner party, just like with just all Vietnamese people. I'm the only white guy there, all Vietnamese. It's probably like 30 or 40 Vietnamese students and me. And I was like, I loved it. Like, I really enjoy learning about other cultures and other foods. And it was just like, it was amazing. It was super fun. And all of a sudden, they start pulling out this karaoke machine.
Nice.
And it's in Vietnamese. But the Vietnamese letters, there's a lot, like, they're like English letters. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm like crazily mistaken right now. But they're like English letters. And there are like some differences. But like, it's in English. So I can see what it says. There are some like differences in intonation, but for whatever reason, it just makes sense to me in my brain, right?
Like how it's spelled,
how it's supposed to sound,
yeah.
The way the letters are supposed to sound. I just understand just from hearing them talk what it's supposed to sound like. Some people, numbers make sense to them. Numbers don't make sense to me. For whatever reason, accents, they just make sense to me. So they're like, do you want to try it? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so I start doing karaoke in Vietnamese. And when I tell you that 40 Vietnamese college kids' jaws dropped when I started like speaking in very good, like a really good Vietnamese accent and pronouncing the words correctly, they're like, they paused it. They were like, do you speak Vietnamese? Yeah, I was like, I have no clue what I'm saying. I was like the star. They were like, do another song. They just wanted to see the white guy like sing in Vietnamese. So if you hold the lines I'm supposed to read up on like a big card in Spanish, I should be able to do it and be pretty convincing.
There you go.
Tell me what emotion I'm supposed to be feeling. And I think I can make it work.
That's awesome. That's such a cool experience. I feel like I want that for everybody to like be immersed in a different culture in that way. Like, that's so awesome.
Dude, it's super important. I really think it's funny. Like, my mom got a lot of flack from other moms when I went to Israel instead of going to college. And I think it was just the, and it still is, but even, you know, back then over a decade ago, I think it was like even more of just the norm, like this, your kids go to college. And so when my mom would say like, yeah, my son's taking a year off, like there was like undertones of judgment and like, why is he doing that? Should just go right to school. And I feel like now it's getting to be a little bit more like, oh yeah, taking a gap year, go travel. That's good for you. I'm like, I know there'll be a lot of surprises with being a parent, but like, I'm very excited to encourage my daughter to just take time off and not go right to college. And if she even wants to go to college, which she doesn't need to, but like, go travel, go live with another family, go learn another language, go live in another culture. I think it's unbelievably important, even just like, never mind the friends that you'd make and all of that, but just the perspective shift that you have in terms of globally, in term, I feel like there's, it's so easy like to think about another culture, another country, and not really fully internalize that they're real humans. Just like us with families and emotions and like all this stuff. It's so easy. Like same thing with social media. You interact with someone on social media and you forget that the person on the other side of the screen is a real human with real emotions, with real feelings, with like they're a real individual, and it's easy like to dehumanize them unconsciously. And I feel like that happens all the time when you just think about people in other countries. So just going and spending time with them is unbelievably important.
Yeah. You know, on that note, I do think that college can provide that for a lot of people, especially depending on where you go. But I do think like the idea of like going somewhere else for college, and there's people from all over the country and all over the world that are there, and like you have that experience where like suddenly you fall in with a bunch of Vietnamese, and like I do think that that can open some doors and some windows for people too. Not to turn this into like, is college good debate?
Yeah, no, we can, but like I think you're right. It provides the opportunity. The question is if college kids will take that opportunity. The reason that I was so willing to do that is I had just spent a year in the Middle East, and I was really tired of the, like, I didn't want to be part of the party culture in America. And like, I just happened to like, I like seeked out these individuals. It wasn't like they just happened to be there and then like, we just happen to become friends. Like it was a lot of effort to make that happen. And I feel like college can present those opportunities because often there are many people from all over the place. But if you're not actively seeking it out and actively putting effort in, it's going to be really difficult. Whereas if you go to another country, like you're immersed in it, unless, and this is another, you don't have a choice. And I was going to say, unless though, I know people who studied abroad with other, you know, just Americans, and they didn't even begin to learn the other language, and they just all hung out in the same group. Because even when you're immersing yourself, it's still easy to find what you're used to. And humans, like, I was literally just reading a psychology paper earlier this morning. We are hardwired to find what is normal to us, which is one of the reasons why we will often do things and stay with things, even if it's bad for us, just because we're used to it. So like, even if you're trying to be immersed in another culture, it can still be difficult if you're surrounded by others who are like you or from the same place as you. I remember when I first moved to Israel when I was 18, because there were other Americans near me, I literally had to make time to go away from them. And I think I've told you how I like really started to learn Hebrew is I would learn one sentence, like, where's the bus station? And then I would go out in Tel Aviv and I would start asking people in Hebrew, like, where's the bus station? And I would start learning the directions. I would learn, you know, go straight down here, take a right here, you hit the traffic light. That's how I started learning Hebrew. But there were many people that I was with, many Americans who like, they were just hanging out with Americans. So they didn't learn Hebrew because they weren't taking the effort to do that. So yes, the opportunities begin to present themselves in college, and the opportunities are even more likely when you go to another country. But it's something that you actually have to pursue and really try to put yourself out there, because if you left to your own devices, human nature will take over and you'll find people that are similar to you and like you and actually keep you in a comfort zone and a bubble, which will make it harder to actually immerse yourself.
So I have family in Peru, as you know, and then I also have family in Panama. And in Peru, so my parents, they would send me down there every summer for many years when I was a kid, and it was awesome. I mean, that's how I learned how to speak Spanish. That's, I think it was a very similar experience to what you're describing of like being immersed in another culture mm-hmm. and like really learning about it and being a part of it. And I remember the contrast between going to Peru, where, yeah, they would take an English class, but most people didn't really speak English. They would know some words. And then in Panama, everyone spoke English, at least in my family and their circles, like fluently, like really, really good English. And so I would go to Peru and it was like, if I didn't know a word, we'd have to like figure it out, you know,
right.
We'd have to like point at each other and like, you know, try to figure like, you mean this, you mean that. And then I would go to Panama and it's like, as soon as I kind of like slipped up or I pronounced something wrong or whatever, they would just switch to English.
Yes. Yes.
It was so frustrating. And I know that they were doing it to be kind and to like meet me where I was. But for me, it was like, no, like I want to
struggle.
I want to like work through this and learn and get better. So it was just an interesting contrast that this conversation reminded me of.
Yeah. It's so funny because I had very similar, even now, if I go to Israel, or even if I'm here in America and I meet someone Israeli and I start trying to speak Hebrew, like, no, like immediate English. But even in Israel, that'll happen. And I realized it's not even because they're trying to be kind per se. It's actually because they like practicing their English.
Right. It's the reverse.
They're like, oh, cool. All right. This is a good opportunity for me to practice my English. Then they'll switch to English. And there were many situations in which I would be speaking to an Israeli. I would be speaking in terrible Hebrew and they would be speaking in like pretty good English. And we would be going back and forth. So it's like, it can be really difficult to do that. And which is why if you want to immerse yourself, like, it takes effort, even if you're in that other country. Like you have, like for you when you're in Panama, I bet had to go to a restaurant and like try and like order in Spanish in that restaurant, or like ask for directions, or just go somewhere where they didn't know you. And it takes a lot of effort, which is why, especially on a college campus, yeah, the opportunities are there, but it's difficult. And especially as a college kid, I think it's really tough. Which is, I think, if you have the opportunity to college kid, you should study abroad. I remember being in college and I had friends, or probably closer to acquaintances, who were, I was like, are you going to study abroad? I had just come off the year and I was like, you should study abroad. And I went to Delaware, University of Delaware. And it's like, they're from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And they're like, no, I'd miss my friends too much. And I'm like, are you stupid? Like
you just met them.
It's even like their family or like that was close. It's like they'll be here when you get back. It's like just it's a semester and it could change your. I never met a single person who studied abroad who regretted it. I've always met many, many, many people who regretted not studying abroad. It's something that if you have an opportunity to do it, do it. And you know what's really cool is there's many opportunities for adults that people don't even realize it, for people who are post-college, even in their 30s and 40s, like Google search, like subsidized programs to travel the world. And you will find there are so many programs that will literally, if not fully subsidized, like pay a huge percentage just for you to go there. Because a lot of these countries, they want you to go and experience it so you can remove the stigma that's associated with the country. Mm-hmm. And like, it's a program where you can go almost, if not fully for free, and just like learn about it. It's amazing. They're all over the place.
That's rad. To tie this back into health and fitness, I do think immersion is difficult in a similar way as training consistently and hard for the first time. I think that like your inertia wants to bring you back and it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't always want to be facing that discomfort, but the more you do it, the easier it gets and the more you enjoy it and the more rewarding it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just talking about this the other day with my buddy, Mike. We have a podcast for personal trainers. If you are a personal trainer, I'll put the link in the show notes. Momentum is so huge with fitness, which is one of the reasons why, for example, I actually posted this on my story yesterday. I didn't expect to get a big response, but I got a bigger response than I expected. I was speaking about how I've only been training jiu-jitsu 1 to 2 times a week. And the reason I like didn't fully stop when I had the opportunity to not fully stop was because of momentum. And if I stopped altogether, getting it back up from nothing is way more difficult than like just keeping the needle moving a little bit, keep the ball rolling a little bit. And what's funny is even me, like training just 1 to 2 times a week, I can feel that I've like lost momentum. So even for those 1 to 2 days, it's difficult. I'm like, oh shit. But I have my coach, like I've scheduled the appointment. I can't bail on it. So I have to do it, but I can feel that it's even harder to do it now than it was when I was going 4, 5, 6 times a week when it was just part of my daily schedule. And so when you're going from nothing to something, the barrier and the feelings of overwhelm can be very overwhelming, not to be redundant, but it's like, it's super difficult. But just that's why my approach is generally, let's do the minimum effective dose. Like, let's just get you there. Let's just start you walking. Let's just, not only because it's actually effective and it does make a huge impact on your health, but because the bigger the barrier to entry, the bigger the more difficult it is to actually begin, the less likely you are to do it. Mm-hmm. And so like starting with the minimum effective dose, and I was there, Peter Attia had a great thought recently I heard, and it's accurate, is that when you go from like 0 to 30%, the effects on your health are much more prevalent than going from like 70 to 90%, for example, or like even 70 to 100%. When you're starting at zero and you can go from 0 to 30%, the health benefits that you get from it are unbelievable. Like they're gargantuan. But you could take the same percentage difference, like 60 to 90%, and the health benefits are not nearly as much as that initial 30%. And so it's so important to help people just get in there and realize like, yeah, it's super difficult, but you have to do it. I also saw a great quote the other day. I thought it was definitely worth bringing up. You know how people often say, I would die for my family. Like I would die mm-hmm. for it. And it's like, I agree. I would die for my family. But would you be willing to get healthy for your family? Right. And it's like dying for your family in many instances, and this is going to might piss people off, but like in some instances, it wouldn't take much effort, right? Like in our brain, the dying for our family is often like, okay, you're getting killed. You're trying to save someone's life. Cool. Like, and it can be selfless for sure, but getting healthy is going to take way more effort in our mind. And so it's like, okay, so you die for your family, which is amazing. But are you willing to get healthy for your family? Are you willing to do that? And like that is, that quote really hit me where it's like, all right, like let's be real about this. Like how much effort are you really willing to put in for your family?
Yeah, I love that. And that actually segues into our first question of the day. Let me just find this one because it's pretty much about that.
I'll just cut out the dead space, brother, when I'm in post, when I'm editing it.
Oh, yeah? Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, so this is from Lauren Fine. Question for the Jordan Syatt podcast. I loved the conversation of this week's podcast about how to talk to loved ones when they're dieting or restricting in unhealthy ways. Wanted to see if you could elaborate on a similar subject, how to talk to loved ones about the importance of health and wellness, i.e. you have family members who need to lose some weight, should exercise more, eat better, portion control, etc. How do you help them without coming off judgmental or rude? I just want them to be around for a long time and maintain healthy lifestyle habits.
It's a great question. And one of the first books that I recommend all coaches read is also one of the first books I recommend literally anybody read if you want to have a conversation that leads to someone making a change. What are you drinking there? Is that coffee? Chai?
That's my matcha latte.
Matcha latte. Let's go. It's called Motivational Interviewing. And there are many versions of it. I just get the original text. Motivational Interviewing is an amazing, amazing, amazing book. And for me, the best part, the practical part, was looking at the sample conversations that they have. I do think it's important to read the whole book, but when you get to the sample conversations, for me, it helped outline, okay, so this is practically what it means. But most people, especially when we're talking to family and friends, but also in general, they approach conversations completely and utterly wrong. And it's actually funny. I'm also reading a book right now. It reminds me a lot of motivational interviewing. It's called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss, who is an FBI hostage negotiator. And he's essentially talking about how to negotiate with people to help essentially to get what you want. But the way that he frames it is literally motivational interviewing, because motivational interviewing is, it helps the individual feel like they're coming up with the answer on their own. Right. And so when you had this conversation, you know what the right answer for them to come out is. Like, you know what the right answer is. But if you just tell them what the right answer is and say, this is what you need to do, you're going to meet a lot of resistance. There's headbutting, there's defensiveness, they dig their heels in. You need to get them to come up with it, which frankly, it takes a lot more time, and the conversation or conversations more likely take a lot longer. But that's what's actually going to lead to lasting change. You know the right answer, but just by telling them the right answer, they're going to be like, fuck you, I'm not going to do that. You need to literally, and I'm going to use this word, and people have a negative connotation with this word, but you can use it for good or bad, manipulate the conversation in a way that allows the individual to feel like they came up with the answer on their own. That's motivational interviewing. And that's what Chris Voss is discussing in Never Split the Difference. I recommend motivational interviewing first, because it's actually like, it's made for psychology and for health and fitness professionals, and it was originally made for alcohol and smoking cessation. Mm-hmm. They do have one now for fitness professionals. I've never read that one, so I just read the original text. But it's interesting to hear Chris Voss, a hostage negotiator, literally use motivational interviewing in life or death scenarios, as opposed to a little bit more of a relaxed scenario. And he doesn't call it that, but what he's describing is quite plainly motivational interviewing. And so I think both would be wonderful books. I would say Never Split the Difference is more entertaining, because he has some crazy stories about hostage negotiations and business negotiations and all of that. But motivational interviewing really explains exactly how it's supposed to be done. Anyway, with that in mind, it's very easy with family members in particular to get impatient and just say, well, just do this. Just do this, which is, for whatever it's worth, it's usually why you shouldn't take on a family member as a client. Mm-hmm. You should probably refer them to someone else, because it's so easy to get, like, by the end of the day, by the time you're interacting with them, your empathy cup might be drained fully. You just might not have the wherewithal to treat them with the respect that they deserve from a professional perspective, which I think it's usually the best thing to refer them to another coach who maybe you're friends with, so that they can get a wonderful coaching experience. So with that being said, though, if you are speaking with a family member and maybe you're not their coach, you just want to help them move along the process of change, then understanding motivational interviewing and how to literally manipulate the conversation to get them to come up with the idea on their own is the most important thing. And I think the starting point, the most difficult part, is understanding this isn't going to be a 30-second conversation, minute conversation. This isn't going to be a 10-minute conversation. Generally, it's a 45 to 60 minute conversation, but repeated. This could take place over and over and over and over again, which again is why it's helpful to have someone else whose job this is, because that's what they're paid to do. Whereas, you know, it can be very difficult to have repeated hour-long conversations with people, because when you're trying to get them to come up with the idea on their own, it takes time and there's a process. And so what I will say is, when you're having these conversations, you want to make sure, number one, that they know you love them no matter what. It's an unbelievably important. If there's any feeling of guilt or shame, the statistical likelihood of this actually working diminishes gargantuanly. The guilt or shame complex is a very, very, very dangerous route to go down. There's a very small percentage of people who respond positively to shame or guilt. And when I say positively, like behaviorally, they might respond in the way that you want, but psychologically and emotionally, it's still a negative, and they will not like you for it, and they'll not be appreciative of it. And it could actually do harm down the road, but behaviorally that might make the changes you want. But that's literally like 3% or less of people. The vast majority of people, like 97% plus, it's unbelievably helpful to know that you love them and you're there for them. Now, I'll start by saying, even before we get to the big conversations, these 45, 60 minute conversations, when you change how you respond to their daily activities, big things can happen. So for example, especially with family, it's really difficult, because let's say you see like your family member is very overweight, very high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and you just want them to make a change, but they're not. And then when they go and get, I don't know, chips and crackers from the pantry, and you look at them, you don't even have to say anything. You just give them a judgmental look. Not good. If you're like, really, you're going to have that even after all we've spoken about? Not good. Mm-hmm. Like, these are very, very, very bad ways of going about it. And for family, it's so easy to pick on the negative. Oh, really? You're doing this or you're not doing this? Like, just be negative. What's a better thing to do is when you see them doing something positive, you go over the freaking top. If they have water, you're like, pause and say, I love that you're getting water. That makes me so happy. And make sure, you know, you don't say it in a patronizing way. Just be like, I love that you're getting water. Listen, I know you love soda. I love soda too, but I see that you're getting water. And I just want to let you know, I love you. And I'm really proud of you for doing that. Like, that has such a greater benefit than nitpicking the negative and pointing out the negative. This is another way of essentially trying to get people to live up to their own highest expectation of themselves. Because now when you really praise that one positive thing, they want to do it again. They want to keep doing that positive thing. They want to, we all love praise in some way, shape, or form. So going over the top on that, even for something that in your mind, then this is the issue. People are like, well, they should be doing that. So why would I praise it? Fucking praise it. Maybe they should be doing it, but they haven't, or they've been struggling with it. So praise it. Go over the top praising it. I guarantee there are things in your life that you should be doing that you're not, that if you got praised for it, you'd feel good about it and you'd like to do it again. So praise, praise, praise the positive, even the teeniest, tiniest little things. Like if they say they went on a 20-minute walk today, you shouldn't in your mind be like, well, yeah, you should be going for a walk. You should be like, I'm so freaking proud of you. Or even invite them on a walk. Hey, let's just go on a quick walk. You don't even have to call it a walk. You could be like, I just want to talk for a few minutes. Go on and just ask them how their day was and then make it a walk. And at the end of the walk, be like, I'm really proud of you. Like, I'm really glad that we went on this walk. And use the language that makes sense to you. If saying you're proud of someone isn't the language that you use, you could be like, I really appreciate you doing this with me. Like, this was really fun. I'm really glad that you got some steps in. We got steps in together. Like, this makes my heart full. Something like that. You can change the language however you want, but make sure it's praising them. And there's infinite ways to do it. You just have to be creative and think about it, but always praise the positive. And doing that behaviorally on a daily basis is unbelievably helpful. From that point, now, if you're going to have like a real conversation and you sit down with them, it's really about asking questions. And so I spoke about the podcast, I have my buddy Mike, we have a whole business that's geared towards helping coaches become better coaches and build their business. And this is a major part of what we discuss. We have a whole course on the psychology of behavior change and how to work with clients. But the major issue that I see coaches making is essentially the same issues that family members make, which is they just tell them what the answer is. Just do this. I wish it was that easy. Like, I really wish it was that easy. It's not that easy. And oftentimes because the person knows what the answer is, like they're aware. They know they should be eating more fruits and vegetables. They know they should be exercising. They know there are reasons why they're not doing it. So when you just say, you just need to do this, you're immediately met with resistance for so many reasons, not least of which being like, I know, motherfucker. Like, I am well aware that I need to be doing that. But oftentimes they're not going to admit it. They get a little bit stubborn. So then it just becomes headbutting. I generally like to start with questions. Like, hey, like, how are you feeling? How are you feeling with your health and fitness? What's going on? One of my favorite questions I'll ask clients is, and this is a little bit later in the conversation, but oftentimes this is the easiest way that I've found. And I'm like, I like to toot my own horn because like this question, frankly, is genius and it works like basically every time. Is if I really want to get to the point, if they're sort of feel like they're dancing around the issue and they're not letting me get to the point that I want to make, I'll be like, okay, listen, how about we do this? Tell me one thing that you're doing really well with your health and fitness and one thing that you think you can improve with your health and fitness. This question is wonderful because it gives them an opportunity to be proud of themselves and to tell you what they're doing well. Maybe they've been getting more sleep. Maybe they've been eating less junk, whatever it is. But then it really gives them an opportunity to also be honest and say like, but I do think like I need to improve with hitting my calories or getting my steps, whatever it is. what's also great about this is it gives you an opportunity to realize the thing that they struggle with most. So you can also go over the top praising them on it whenever they actually do it. It gives you real insight. Another little trick with this question is I'd say 9.8 people out of 10 will answer this question truthfully. A very small percentage of people will be like, there's nothing that I can improve. Like, I'm doing great. Very small percentage. So just to sort of ward that off before I let them answer, I say, what's one thing that you think you're doing really well? And being 100% truthful, 100% objective, being fully honest with me, what's one thing you think you can improve? Just asking people for honesty will oftentimes like lead to, okay, I'll be honest now, which is funny. Like, I know it shouldn't have to be that way, but it does work when you just say like, just fully honest with yourself and with me, what's one thing you think you can improve? That will often just get people being a little bit more introspective and bring down the defensive barriers. So from that point, it's just asking questions. It's like, okay, like, how can I help you with this? Like, what can I do? Like, what do you think is going to help you get there? Is there anything that you think that you're doing that you think you can improve, or any actions you can take that are going to help you get to this point, that are going to help you make this more sustainable, more of a habit? Asking questions to get them to lead them to the point where they say, well, I could do this or I could do that. It's really it. And the questions take much, much longer. It's funny because in Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference, he regularly talks about these hostage negotiations that take 3, 6, 10 hours. And I'm listening and laughing because it's like people want to end these conversations in 10 minutes. It's like, this is a conversation that he's there all day. It's like 10 hours of a hostage negotiation. And at one point he mentioned it, he was like, just so you know, these conversations take a long time. If you listen, like, that negotiation was a 9-hour hostage negotiation before they finally came out. And so it points back to, this isn't a conversation to have fleetingly or just like in passing. This is a conversation where if you're going to have this conversation, the responsibility is on you to make it like, sit down and have a real conversation and don't try and rush it and don't try and force the answer down their throat. The more you do that, the less it's going to work.
I feel like that was such a complete answer that I have no follow-ups on that.
Love that. Let's go. 9 a.m., man, just really giving out my absolute best.
Yeah, these conversations definitely take on a different quality in the morning, I think, than the afternoon sessions.
What do you mean? Like they're better in the morning?
They're different. I feel like, you know, before you've still got your whole day ahead of you. For me, it's like I haven't done anything but get up and like think about this podcast and get ready and then be here. So it's like I don't have any overhead from the day. It's just like,
Yeah, I like that.
All right. So this one is also based on that same podcast.
Which podcast was this again?
It was a Q&A, and one of the questions was, what do you do if you feel like someone's being overly restrictive in an unhealthy way?
Yeah,
to talk to them.
Do you want to link that one in the show notes just in case people missed it?
Yeah. Okay, so this one is from Kayla Christine. Hello, I'm reaching out with a question for the Jordan Syatt podcast. I listened to the most recent episode with the question, what to do if a loved one's diet is unhealthy or dangerous? I have a follow-up question. I followed Jordan for quite some time and love his message so much. I have struggled with yo-yo dieting and a disordered relationship with food for as long as I can remember. Someone very close to me started their weight loss journey, and their methods and mindset are unhealthy. Unfortunately, because I'm so close with this person, it can be very triggering for me because of my past struggles. I'm currently on my own fat loss journey, but it is very slow and I've been working really hard to go about it in a consistent, sustainable, and healthy way. The last thing I want to do is make this person feel ashamed or guilty by voicing my own struggles surrounding their methods. What are some ways that I can protect myself from falling into habits for rapid fat loss when I'm regularly in communication with someone in person and on socials that is making these choices?
This is unbelievably difficult. And also, this person's name is Kayla, right?
Yep.
Kayla, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it. Thank you for your support. And thank you for this question. It's a wonderful question. It's unbelievably difficult. This is why, for whatever it's worth, and I'm not I'm not comparing drug addiction to disordered relationships with food. Like they're different. There are many similarities, but like they're different. I'm not comparing them in like the they're the same type of way. I'm just using it as an example. When someone gets out of rehab, in which, you know, people who struggle with disordered eating, like they will often go to rehab as well. So there are a lot of similarities. When someone goes to rehab for drug addiction and then they come back into normal world, real world, the likelihood of them relapsing if they go back and hang out with friends who are using is astronomically higher than if they don't go back and hang out with people that are using. So far be it from me to tell you who to hang out with, but I'm just letting you know it is exponentially more difficult to stick to what you know is right when you're hanging out with people that are doing things that are triggering and bringing up issues you've historically struggled with. Do with that what you will. It's just important for you to know that. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to cut someone off entirely, by the way, but I mean, I have close friends who post super obnoxious shit on social media who I mute their accounts. Like, and they're some of my best friends. And like, I'm not going to unfollow them or block them because they're close friends. And that would probably be an issue, which, by the way, I hate that like social media is such a big player in friendships, or it can be. But like, I mute their accounts so I don't see their stuff. I mute their stories. I mute their posts. And then if, I mean, I don't think this has ever happened, but if they did say like, did you see my post, which literally I don't think has ever happened, I would just be like, oh no, I missed it. Which is like, I did miss it, right? Like I didn't see it.
on purpose.
Like, I deliberately. So like, and there are people who are not really close friends, but other people who are like, have you seen my post? And I mute people all the time. If someone's posts are obnoxious and like, I really just don't want to go through the issues of unfollowing someone, because sometimes that can beget issues. I don't know if I used beget properly. Did I just use beget properly? Beget. I think I did.
I think that works.
Yeah. Beget, give rise to, cause, perfect. Cause that can, cause some problems. I'll just mute them. And so that's number one, especially if you're not hanging out with this person all the time or talking to them all the time. And the main influence is social media. Just mute them. It's amazing. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful tool. In terms of what you can do personally, I think this is where, number one, having a coach is unbelievably beneficial, because you have a soundboard, you have someone to keep you on track, keep you accountable. You can talk to someone about this. If you don't have the funds to hire a coach right now, or it's just not, for whatever reason, in the budget or in the plan, you need to have a way for you to stay objectively aware and conscious of exactly what you're doing and your choices. And this might be something that you do every morning or every night or both, but I think every morning having a like a check-in, okay, here's my plan for the day. I do this for business where it's like, all right, here's my plan for the day. But I also did this when I was getting over binge eating over a decade ago. I would literally plan my day like on a piece of paper at the beginning. And at first it was like, I would say, I'm not going to count my calories today. And I am not going to intermittent fast today. I would literally write this down. I'm not going to do this. And instead, I will have a big breakfast. I will make sure that it fits on one plate. I will have two snacks. Like I will, like I wrote all of this down every single morning. I knew what I was going to do, but by writing it down, it reinforced it in a way that was more real. And it was like, this is the plan for today. No matter what happens, no matter what emotions I have, this is my plan for today. And so I would strongly encourage you to have some type of objective check-in with yourself. I did it in the morning. If you want to add one at night, you're welcome to. But you need to have something that's going to keep you honest and keep you objective and keep you on the straight and narrow. So I think hiring a coach that really aligns with you and what you need would be a wonderful thing, even if it's for a brief time. But if you don't have the funds for that or the ability to do that right now, I think the best thing you can do is mute them on social media so you don't see their stuff. And then you have to keep track of yourself in terms of, you know, having those check-ins, and then also decide if it's worth it to continue hanging out with this person at this frequency. I also don't think there's anything wrong with setting a boundary. Like, I really don't think there's anything wrong with setting a boundary and just being like, listen, hey, I know you're doing this and I support you and I love you. You know my history with disordered eating. And if you don't, then I'll tell it to you. But talking about anything diet related is very bad for me. So like, I love you and I support you, but like, if when we hang out, I just don't want to hear about weight loss. I don't want to hear what diet you're following. I don't like setting that boundary is not bad or wrong. If they get upset about that, well, then they weren't a real friend, to be very honest with you. If one of my friends was like, hey, listen, I can't, let's say I have a friend and I'm just making this up. Let's say I have a friend who is like, hey, listen, maybe they had a big business and then it just completely fell apart for whatever reason. And they were like, hey, listen, I don't want to talk about business with you. I just want, like, I would never talk about business. Like, that would be fine. It wouldn't be an issue for me at all because as their friend, I care about what they're going through and what they want to do. So if this person like can't, God forbid, not talk about their diet or their weight loss, that's an issue. So I don't think it's bad at all to set a boundary and say like, listen, this is just isn't going to be good for me mentally, emotionally. When we hang out, I just want to talk about other stuff. Then I think that would be a very fair thing for you to do.
Yeah, totally. Figure out a way to set a plan and stick to it regardless of what they're doing, and then try to keep their influence from affecting you 100% as much as possible. Yeah. All right. So this one is from Erica Gordon. Hi, Tony. I've been a competitive boxer and pretty consistently have had to do mini cuts for competitions. Now my eating habits have completely changed because I'm 18 weeks pregnant.
Let's go.
I have not been tracking, which has been a really nice change. But now that I'm feeling better, I want to start eating better again too. Is there any guidance you may have in terms of calorie intake? I'm not tracking when pregnant. Sometimes I get in my head that I'm just eating what I want, vacation style, just because I can.
All right. So I'm going to start with this. I am not a pregnancy specialist. This is so far outside of my scope, I can't even begin to tell you. So I am not giving you medical advice. And I think the best thing you can do is speak to your doctor, speak to your OB, speak to a specialist about this. I'm going to give you some personal thoughts and opinions, especially based off of what my wife went through with her first and now her second pregnancy, and just some general concepts to think about. But again, this is not my area of expertise. This is not medical advice. And yeah, so now that that's out of the way, we can discuss it. What I will say is this. The most important thing is that you are fed and you and the baby are healthy. That's like the most important thing by far. I think that I didn't realize, I thought the fitness industry was like real toxic and cancerous, and like it can be. But the pregnancy world, oh my Lord, dude. Have you seen this world? Bro, it is crazy. The judgment, the anger, the vitriol, like it is insane. Everything from the moment someone's pregnant, from like what they're eating or what they're not eating, how they're exercising, how they're not exercising. Are they breastfeeding? Are they not breastfeeding? Are they going to have a home birth? Are they going to have a doula? Are they going to do it in the hospital? Like it, from the moment you're pregnant until forever, everything is the most judgmental, hate-fueled anger. It is crazy how intense this world is. So, the number one thing for me is to say, like, the most important thing is that you are fed and you are healthy and the baby is healthy. That's by far the most important. I will say for my wife's first pregnancy, she basically in the first trimester survived off of macaroni and cheese. That was like, that was it. Like that's like, she had real food aversions. It was really difficult for her. And she really didn't work out much in the first trimester either. Now, I should have her on so she can speak about it, but like I'm literally saying what we've spoken about and what she has expressed to me. So before anyone comes at me, and I'm just saying like literally her thoughts, not my thoughts about it, her thoughts. Now in her second pregnancy, and she's just getting into the second trimester, the nausea is even way worse this time, like way worse this time. That sucks. And a lot of throwing up and a lot of difficulty, but she regretted, and this is just my wife's words, not mine, she regretted not keeping up with her fitness even lightly in that first trimester. And she's really putting in effort this time. Like she's really like, and by that I mean We go on a family walk almost every day, and she's strength training 2 to 3 times a week. And that's it, like very sustainable. But in the first trimester last time, she basically stopped because it was really uncomfortable. And I think also we didn't have a kid in the last one. So like she was able to just sort of relax, and she was working, but like when she wasn't working, she was able to just relax and not do anything. Whereas now we have our daughter. So it's like, there's no relaxing, like we're up anyway. So it's like, all right, I'm going to get workouts in. I'm like, and so it's a little bit different now. And by a little bit, it's a lot of bit different, but she regretted not being a little bit more on point with her nutrition and her fitness because she gained more than she wanted to. And it took her longer, not for me, it took her longer than she wanted to lose the weight, and she lost it, and she looks amazing, and she's incredible. But now she's being more conscious because it was very difficult to lose all of the weight and to get back, and to even, again, talking about momentum, to get back into it. Whereas if she had continued it, the momentum would have been at least a little bit more there and readily accessible for her. So this time she's deliberately trying to keep a little bit more momentum so that after the pregnancy, she can get back into it a little bit more easily. What's interesting now is even though her nausea is worse and her food aversions are worse, she is putting in way more effort now to, you know, keep getting her protein in, keep getting her fiber in. And she still has mac and cheese. Chick-fil-A mac and cheese is ridiculously good, but like, it's not, that's not what she's surviving off of. So I put all this out there just to tell a story, I guess, and to give insight from my wife. And I need to have her on so she can say it, and she will literally say the same thing. But I think it's important just to hear, number one, that the most important thing is that you're fed and that you and the baby are healthy. With that in mind, I don't like to give exact calorie requirements during pregnancy because, again, this is not my area of expertise or specialty. Generally speaking, you don't need as many extra calories as many would say. So like when people say like eating for two, it's like, yeah, I'd say you technically are eating for two because you have a baby inside of you and you're helping grow that baby. But like, it's not like you need to eat an extra 1,000 calories or 1,200 or 1,500 calories. It's actually like generally the range, and this is not medical advice, generally the range is between like 250 to 500 extra calories or so a day. And even that like is significant. But again, please talk to a specialist. Please talk to your doctor about this and understand that even if like you gain more weight than you want, you can always lose it, right? You can always do that. I do think it's important to be aware of your blood pressure. So like, you know, I've got, we don't have the video, but I've got my blood pressure monitor. I always have my blood pressure monitor on my desk, not just so that I can take it, but also because when I first started taking blood pressure, I would get white coat syndrome and it would elevate my blood pressure just like doing it. So you're sort of like having it there and putting it on a couple times a week just habitually has reduced that fear for me or that anxiety, which has been really good for accurate readings. But no matter what, during pregnancy, you should continue to check your blood pressure. It's very dangerous getting high blood pressure, preeclampsia during pregnancy, which is something that we check with my wife at least once a week or so. But from a purely weight and aesthetic perspective, and I know some people are like, why are you worried about aesthetics? It's like, well, some people do care about it. And if you don't, that's fine. But for those who might be caring about aesthetics or even athletic performance, considering this person's a boxer, you can always lose it. You can always, always, always lose it. And some women have to go on complete bed rest during the pregnancy and they can't work out at all. And so like, you can always get your physical capabilities back. You can always, like, once the pregnancy is over, once the child is here and God willing, safe and healthy, you can get it back. You can get back to work. But the most important thing during the pregnancy is that you are fed and you and the baby are healthy. Whatever cost, that's the most important thing. I think as long as you keep that in mind, you can take whatever advice you get with grains of salt and with a greater understanding and say the most important thing over this duration is that I'm healthy and baby's healthy, and whatever happens after, I can get back to my health and fitness once that's over. Worst comes to worst. But there is also, if you have the ability to do your best to maintain a level of health and fitness throughout this, it's very helpful. And I can even see it in my wife right now. She's much happier and much more optimistic now going in her second trimester, being like, I feel way better. My conditioning is way better. Her strength is way better. Like all of that, she feels better and she feels more confident with this pregnancy, which is really cool for me to see.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, I think a lot about when you talk about your mini cuts and whatnot, it's like you've been doing this for forever, you know, like you've been doing cuts and you know how to do it. Like you can sit down and in 30 days execute.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, you know, she's also been very successful as a boxer doing that. So I think that should give some confidence in that, like, hey, like I've been down this road before. I've controlled this before.
100%. Like, you know exactly what to do. And maybe you'll be starting from a point that you haven't been at yet, but the same principles, it's the exact same thing. So.
Awesome. You got time for one more?
Let's do it.
So this is from Uliana Bold. Hi, Tony. Loving you on the podcast with Jordan. You make a great duo. Thank you. Got a question for Jordan. I recently started working full-time as a nurse, and in Canada, the typical schedule is two-day shifts, two night shifts in a row, 12 hours each, and then 4 days off. As someone who also used to binge, I really struggle with the days when I have night shifts. I sleep in 2 to 3 hour naps, and because of this, feel like I'm always hungry. Hungry during the day because it's when I'm used to eating, and hungry at night because I'm awake and working. Any tips on how to structure my meals or snacks?
This is Uliana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the question, Uliana. I love Tony as well. I'll start by saying, and I say this every time someone brings up like a nursing job, it's among the most difficult jobs to have, period, but especially for health and fitness. I think, and I've said this many times, I'll continue to say it because it's true, nursing and truck drivers have like some of the most difficult jobs for health and fitness, and for different reasons. But nursing is unbelievably difficult, especially from a nutrition perspective. Interestingly, nurses generally have an easier time with steps because they are fucking going nonstop for these crazy long shifts. So the good news is, like, you don't really need to worry about steps as much because most nurses I've worked with have had no issues getting easy 10,000 steps a day, like oftentimes 12, 15, 20 plus thousand steps. So that's the good news. The bad news is the nutrition. That's the hard part. Whereas truck drivers, as an aside, their steps are abysmal and we have to come up with real strategies to get that. And they do have more control over their nutrition, but it's also, it's difficult because they're in a fucking truck for like 12 plus hours at a time. And generally the foods that they have at truck stops, or they have great options, but sometimes getting a truck driver to make those choices is really difficult. So like anyway, from a nursing perspective, I also want to say it's also much more difficult if you have a history of binge eating. Like this is a very difficult situation. And I think the first thing I would say is I would strongly encourage you to seek out help, whether it's coaching from someone who specializes with people who struggle with binge eating, or even a therapist, or both. I think it's really important to have a consistent soundboard, not just like this one-time advice from me, but have a consistent soundboard, someone to hold you accountable. And if you can do this, I strongly, strongly urge you to, because I think it will radically increase your likelihood of success over the long term. I would say simultaneous good and bad news is that my advice here is going to be the exact same as my advice basically all of the time, which is you want to make sure you're filling up on protein and fiber. These are like super, super, super important. Most of the nurses that I've worked with have done very well by bringing their own food. There are some hospitals that have really great food available to them in the cafeteria. And I would say most hospitals, the food sucks shit. And so it's just, and not to mention it's expensive, and you know, it's just better if you can bring it. So bringing food will be fantastic. If you don't have the time or the energy to cook your own, there are some really great meal prep services. I don't know any off the top of my head, and I'm not affiliated with any. I sort of want to do some research and like find one and see if I can create a partnership with one that I really stand by and like. But even if you just Google search meal prep services that will literally deliver you meals, that you can find like super great high quality meals that have high protein, high fiber, they hit your calories and macros. It would be less expensive probably than getting the food at the hospital, and more expensive than cooking it yourself. but also it would make it much, much, much easier for you. So I think that would be a really good option. And then I would say, and this is probably one of the most difficult parts, but if you can, and this has worked really well for many of the people I've worked with, is trying to find a consistent time to have your meals, which I know it's unbelievably difficult when you're a nurse because you don't really know what's going to go on and when. But when I say a consistent time, I don't mean like 8:30. I mean, try and have this meal between 7:30 and 9:30. So you have a 2-hour window in which this is when you're having this meal. That way, your body, the hunger hormones in your body, they run on a schedule. Mm-hmm. And so this is why, for example, if you ever had Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever, you had a dinner, a huge holiday meal at like 3 p.m. and you're stuffed and you're like, oh my God, I'm never going to eat again. And then like 3 hours later, somehow you're hungry and you feel like such a fat ass. You're like, how in the hell did that happen?
Every time.
It's crazy. it's because it's not because you're actually hungry. It's not like in terms of you need the calories. It's because your hunger hormones work on a schedule. And if you had that meal at like 3 and you're usually eating dinner between like 6 and 8 or something, your body's like, oh, it's time for me to eat because I consistently eat around this time. So what can be helpful is you can actually help to put your hunger hormones on a schedule by consistently eating around the same times. And it doesn't have to be 8:37, between 7:30 and 9:30. This is just an example, but create like a 2-hour window of like, I have my meal within this window. I have my snack within this window. And then like it takes about 2 to 3 weeks for your hunger hormones to adjust and to normalize at that schedule. So don't expect it to be immediate, but after about a month, you will notice yourself getting hungry at the same times and not being hungry around the same times. And so if you notice that you're hungrier at night, I would save more calories for at night and maybe even potentially more frequent meals or snacks. So like, okay, maybe a snack between like 5:30 and 6:30 and a meal between 7:30 and 8:30 and then another snack between 9:30 and 10:30. So you're almost like consistently eating every hour or so. Whereas earlier in the day, if you're not as hungry, then you can have the more spaced out or smaller meals. I think that would probably be very beneficial.
Yeah. You mentioned Stan Efferding the other day. I forget what the context was, but
I think it's because he's open about his steroid use and I really like him. Yeah.
There you go. He has a meal prep service that I used for a while.
Was it good?
I really liked it.
Good.
Like the idea was like, how do we make all the nutrition you need like easy to digest? And the answer is like shred it up into tiny little bits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like rice with like shredded up vegetables and then like different proteins. And I really liked it. It was easy. So when you're doing research,
did it fill you up?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And like they have different portion sizes, so you can get like the regular, you can get like the bigger ones, and I was getting the bigger ones for me.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
But yeah, you can check
I'll look into that. I'll look into that. Yeah, I like Stan a lot. I didn't know he had that. I know he has like his vertical diet, which I believe is a book. I didn't know he had that, so I'll check that out. I've been meaning to do this for a while, and there were earlier in my career, like 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, there were a lot of those companies reaching out to me and sending me stuff. So I need to go back. And I was like, I still don't like doing affiliate stuff, but if I could find one that I actually really like and that like I stand by and it has high quality food in good portions and it just makes life easier, then I would definitely stand behind that. So yeah, I'll start looking into that.
Nice. Could be a cool YouTube.
All right. Okay, Tony. Okay. you mean like ordering a bunch of different meal prep services and comparing them?
Yeah. I don't know if that gets complicated, but yeah, I think that would be really
interesting. Here's the thing. It would make a great YouTube. It would also probably create some enemies and get people really pissed off. So I just hate doing that stuff. What I would do is I would order it privately and I wouldn't let them know that I'm ordering it. And I would just do it myself and I would figure out which one I think I agree with the most. And then I would just reach out to them and say, hey, I ordered it. Is this something you'd want to do? But doing public stuff like that, man, I really don't like making enemies. I don't. And I, you know what? It's not even just, I don't like making enemies. I don't like making people feel bad. I really don't. And I don't think that, I feel like that type of content does really well when like you're putting people on blast. And I hate that. Especially because like we know there are so many negative mental health aspects of social media. And it's like, I would imagine the people who created these meal prep companies did it with great intent and they're not trying to scam people or anything. And then I go out of my way and say like, this sucks. And it's like, I'm taking this person's life's work that they've spent potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars on or millions. And I'm just like slamming it publicly and potentially really hurting their bottom line and hurting their jobs. It's just like, I don't know. I don't like that stuff. So I would do it privately. It's a great idea, but not for me. I wouldn't do that type of content.
I respect that, man. Cause you do have a platform and some of these are small businesses, I'm sure. And yeah.
It's sort of like when I see people go with big audiences, like slamming like a local restaurant or something because they like fucked up an order or even a waiter was rude or something, like that's not the owner. Like that, it's come on. Like, and then you see the reviews, people like who haven't even been to the restaurant will go and leave negative reviews and like, it can really fuck. Yeah, dude, people like gang up and a real cult mentality. It's not good. I just don't like that stuff. You know,
I created a Yelp account. And I told myself that I would only leave positive reviews.
I love that. You're a good man.
Just because, yeah, I just see, you know, it's like you'd see a review and it would be like 2 stars. And then you'd read it and they're like, the food was great. Like, I like this. I like that. They forgot the lemon for my water. Like, 2 stars. And it's just like, hold on. Like,
yeah. Are you serious? I hate that, dude. I hate it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. So listen, thank you everyone for listening. We both love you. We appreciate you. Thank you for all your support, your encouragement. If you could share the podcast, put on your story, let people know they should listen to it, it would mean the world. If you could leave a 5-star review, especially if you like the podcast, ideally not a 1, 2, 3, or even a 4. 5-star would be best. We'd appreciate it. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you soon.